Wendell Berry writes, "The presence of the creation here makes this a holy place, and it is as a pilgrim that I have come. It is the creation that has attracted me, its perfect inner fusion of life and design. I have made myself its follower and its apprentice. It is the privilege and labor of the apprentice of creation to come with his imagination into the unimaginable, and with his speech into the unspeakable." Over the past 9 years, I've worked at Star Island as island naturalist, apprenticed to this presence in its many expressions, peering into the hidden world of plankton, observing local flora and fauna, guiding and diverting manic children, and commuting with adults and ancient rocks. It has nourished my soul. I have been blessed to see a generation of children grow and mature in wild play and exploration. Star Island is both a sanctuary for old traditions and a place to explore new ways and ideas of being. The distractions of daily life on the mainland are mostly absent, and there's a sense of unpressured playfulness in the air. In my job as a naturalist, I need to be present and attentive to the flows of island life. In a week, this might be plants coming in and out of flower, watching for significant tides, the rhythm of the children's programs, and boat schedules, always boat schedules. The shifting interests of individual guests and volunteers, the fogs and squalls and majesties of lightning storms passing by at a distance, or rattling the building as they pass overhead. I see how landscapes have evolved from changing use in the introduction of species, both planned and unplanned. I see how weekly conferences differ and how the overall conferences evolve based on best practices or lazy habits. I see how kids grow, generally better, year after year. I develop an appreciation of deep time and climate disruption. This work has led me to a few questions which I'd like you to consider with me. I've been wondering where love starts and how it grows. For the moment, I'll agree with Berry and say it starts with attraction. Gene Wilhelm, in his work Theology of Ecology, writes, "Cosmic allurement, the attraction of things for each other, is the foundation of existence in the universe." Closely followed by the creative expression that ensures that each manifestation, although of a type, is a unique expression. All my scientific study has confirmed this. Everything I know about the world confirms this. In Michael Pollan's book, The Botany of Desire, plants evolve well-turned sepals and pronounced stamens to lure honeybees or humans to do their bidding. This flimflammery has developed over eons of experimentation and cross-species relationship. Bee and flower and human are not independent of one another. They are wedded to a mutual relationship that extends over generations. We're starting to get to love. Attraction plus effort over time, a shared history of mutuality and adjustments. Microbiologist Lynn Margulis, one of my personal science heroes, transformed our understanding of biology and evolution. She was a primary proponent of the Gaia theory, which views the biosphere as a vast self-regulating system that seeks to maintain the conditions necessary for life. Complex feedback loops recycle materials and maintain a balance which would not otherwise occur. In other words, not only is there life on Earth, the Earth itself is alive. Serial endosymbiogenesis endosymbiogenesis theory revolutionized our thinking about how nucleated cellular life on Earth began. Microorganisms often collaborate with one another as each has different requirements and makes available different resources. New species often happen when crisis makes this mutual dependency critical to the existence of both parties, and one party is subsumed into another. Bacteria often share their genes by eating one another. There is strong evidence that cell organelles, like chloroplasts, mitochondria, and flagella, the things that get power energy from the sun or allow us to metabolize that energy or move around, were acquired this way by bacteria eating one another with special skills and incorporated into plant and animal cells. We're familiar with lichens and corals, which are mutually dependent trans-species organisms. And think for a moment about the roughly 90% of the cells in your body, which are actually communities of bacteria that make it possible for you to function. It makes one question what an individual is. So love does indeed keep us together. But it's primarily life-affirming trans-species relationships and microbiological communities that allow us to continue to exist, not our concern for one another or our care of the communities we depend upon. Now, what can we give back? We are dependent mostly on things we can't see and that we have been taught to fear. Germs, bacteria. We arm ourselves against them, generally harming the good ones and helping the bad ones evolve immunity to our weapons. Aldo Leopold introduced the idea of a land ethic in his 1949 book, A Sand County Almanac, expanding the idea of community into all entities within a locale. When we see land as a community, he says, to which we belong, we may begin to use it with love and respect. For an ethic, he says, a thing is right when it tends to preserve the integrity, stability, and beauty of the biotic community. It is wrong when it tends otherwise. He wasn't pushing rules, but an attitude, a way of caring for a relationship that many of us do not recognize. So what do we love? How do we show it? I've come to love the land, to recognize and embrace my communities in a broader sense than I had before. Sometimes to love is to suffer, to feel the loss when the lover is taken away, to fear harm to them when parted. Our gut bacteria and our partners can make sure that we suffer when we abuse them and feel joy when they are happy. Our connection to the land is not so neurologically dependent, but we do suffer the consequences of our abuse. Leopold notes that an ecologist must either harden his shell and make believe that the consequences of science are none of his business, or he must be a doctor who sees the marks of death in a community that believes itself well and does not want to be told otherwise. I can no longer look at a landscape and just appreciate its beauty. The beauty is amplified because I often see how it came to be and view the interactions within it like an art historian might view a painting. But I also see the loss of its magnificence, the state of its decline. I mourn its approaching end, even as I am transfixed by beauty on so many levels. The study of geology has helped to extend the lens of time, for the land goes on. Ecosystems come and go, species disappear, but the process continues. We are dependent on the land. It is not dependent upon us. However, we can help restore the damage we have caused. There are stories in the landscape, not just those written in the rocks that geologists decipher, but also genetic signatures that tie together plants, animals, and bacteria into an interactive whole. And peopled landscapes, transformed by human presence into working landscapes that have survived human-caused ecological failures or avoided them altogether because of the sensitivity of the people living there. Peopled landscapes often record in their names and lore the events and people that went before. I mentioned the Piscataqua and the Cochico. Sometimes the stories are supernatural, other times mundane, sometimes heroic, sometimes dreadful. But they always imbue the landscape with a human connection and historical continuity with the past. They connect us to the land and to communities that work the land. We are losing these stories. Wendell Berry would say that in the past 50 years, we have, as a society, have chosen to destroy those relationships we had with small communities in the land. We are losing the stories that ground us to place. In his writings, Berry tries to commemorate a way of life he sees passing away. Others try to incorporate past traditions into modern life. The Icelanders have stories about the hidden people, trolls and elves who populate the landscape, and they bring in experts on trolls and elves to help plan highway development and other things so as not to disturb them. The Apache have place names for their sacred sites that tell the origin stories of their ancestors coming to that place. So if you know the name of a place, you understand its essence and its history. The general drift to society has been towards more, bigger, newer things at the expense of human and ecological relationships. On TV, the internet, and elsewhere, our insecurities are constantly played upon to elicit a response. We are unrooted. Our stories tell us who we are. Most Star Island stories commemorate the dead and warn of the fragility of life. But my favorite Star Island story is one many of you were involved in. A seacoast miracle that celebrates the power of the people. Governor Meldrum Thompson, the Manchester Union leader, and Aristotle Onassis planned to put an immense oil refinery in Great Bay with a transshipment depot in the Isles of Shoals and a pipeline through Rye and Greenland. Every political and economic institution in the state was trying to force this down our throats. The people of the seacoast, already organized from fighting Seabrook, managed to stop the project, just barely. A first-term state legislator named Dudley Dudley led a coalition that passed a home rule bill in special session, which allowed Durham residents to veto the refinery. It is a miracle that the Great Bay Estuary and the Isles of Shoals ecosystems still exist. A hard-fought miracle, won by many people in this room and elsewhere in the seacoast, who came together across political lines to protect the place they called home. This was our water protector's moment. In the winter of 1623, while lying near death, Elizabethan Christian mystic John Donne wrote Devotions upon Emergent Occasions. Dying being an emergent occasion, I suppose. His most remembered excerpt reflected on our interdependence. No man is an island entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. And any man's death diminishes me because I am involved in mankind. Therefore, never send to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee. But Don's lens was too narrow. It is not just humans. We are interdependent all the way down, from nation states to bacterial colonies to subatomic forces. Remember the land ethic. Remember the communities you belong to. We cannot focus on any one issue at the expense of others. we need to address the interconnections and the whole and do what we can. So how do we save what we love? The world we know is under attack on so many levels. We need to act on many levels. We cannot act alone. We must build coalitions with other community groups in ways that live out our values. We need to stand firm against exploitation of the land and its people. We need to learn, write, and tell the stories of this place so we can be strengthened by its magic and the exploits of those who went before us. We must not be despondent, but cling to our vision and inspire others to share that vision. We must act in sorrow and joy, for much that we love will be lost. But from the remnant, a new world will grow, and we will discover a deeper, richer world in that process. In the words of Langston Hughes' poem, Island, "Wave of sorrow, do not drown me now. I see the island still ahead somehow. I see the island and its sands are fair. Wave of sorrow, take me there."